Hello and welcome to another installment, and a very special installment of History Hack. I have a little bit of a smirk on my face today because we've brought you some pretty mind-blowing episodes in the past. This is, I think, another one. Matt, why am I particularly smug today?
Well, we're always very proud of our guests, but today we have the best-selling author of more than 30 books, which is like that whole bookshelf over there worth of books, including series such as Eagles of the Empire, the Wellington and Napoleon Quartet. The books have been translated over 20 languages. There's millions of them. So ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to welcome Simon Scarra to History Hack. Simon, how are you, sir?
I'm very well today, thank you.
Super. We're really excited about this, and we're going to sort of talk about lots of your books, including the new one, which we'll get to in a bit. Just depends on how how many rabbit holes we go down. But it's a real pleasure to have you with us. We've already been chatting, and we've already regretted not hitting record as soon as we started, because we'll have to work those gems back in. But let's kick this off. Really, a question I always love to ask authors, really. When you start writing, that sort of that spark of inspiration for a historical fiction writer, what attracts you to a genre? What makes you zero in on something saying, yes, I want to spend time in that era?
Well, in the case of the Roman novels, I was lucky enough to go to a grammar school that still taught Latin and Greek back in the day. And I wasn't, I'll be honest, I wasn't a particularly good student of the languages, and I didn't see a huge amount of relevance for learning these languages in the modern world, if I'm honest. But at the same time, the Latin teachers were really, really effective at interesting you in the wider aspects of Roman culture. So when they started, stopped talking about the past pluperfect, whatever, and started talking about Roman plumbing, or the campaigns of Hannibal or something like this, then the whole thing came alive. And this was at a time when we had I, Claudius on television, the BBC series, which was really pretty gripping and pretty racy stuff for the 70s. I think that's the first time I ever saw a woman's nipple on TV, to be honest. So quite interesting for a teenage boy. And at the same time, on the weekends, of course, you'd have films like Cleopatra, Spartacus, Fall of the Roman Empire, Demetrius and the Gladiators. So there just seemed to be a lot of Roman stuff, about. And then I had, in the history, when I was doing history A-level, they came up with this optional module. The Cambridge University syllabus came up with this module on Roman Britain. And my history teacher at the time, was a guy called Jonathan Mills, who had been teaching me history for the previous few years. And he was brilliant. He saw history as a kind of, the way to kind of lure the kids in is to teach it as a soap opera. So, you'd be talking about something and he'd go, and Henry VIII could have married Catherine of Aragon, or we shall find out in the next lesson. So we'd all come piling back the next day, and he was very old school, had us line up and he'd sort of inspect us and before we go into the classroom. And so, we were gripped. And then when you're doing A-level and suddenly it becomes a slightly more serious subject, it's not just about the narrative, it's about assessing the evidence and doing research and making the case. He was really, really good at encouraging you to take that step up. And as I said, we did this Roman Britain thing. And actually, Jonathan is the guy I've dedicated the 20th book in the series to. His son got in touch and said, oh, my dad used to teach you history at school. And so that sort of reopened the acquaintance. And it's a huge pleasure to be able to express your gratitude to a teacher you haven't seen for nearly 40 years, because he's had a big, big influence on me. So a combination of great history teaching and an interest in Roman culture really got the ball rolling.
There's not much more of a legacy you can have as a teacher than to inspire somebody to go and write novels that sell in the millions. I mean, talk about a job well done. When it comes to recreating these past worlds, and you've done it with a few different worlds, and we'll talk about specific examples in a moment, I'm really interested in the process, because you have a very different job to what myself and Boney do. We can just kind of focus on the facts and we relate the facts. You're trying to achieve a very different thing, because you need to grip the reader, yet parachute them into a world that feels authentic. So how do you go about that process of translating a historian's research into something that has an authentic and engaging feel for the reader?
I think it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, you know, essentially you're writing history, but you're writing history in a more speculative manner. So obviously the starting point is to go to the historical works on the era that you're particularly interested in. And that, of course, is a huge amount of pleasure. One of the problems with writing is the pleasure of research. You know, I can spend months and months and months writing, researching, and then, you know, I'm putting off writing, and I'll get a call from the editor who says, you know, so Simon, that book you're handing in next month, how's it going? And that usually is the signal to get cracking, and late nights, peanut butter sandwiches and tenant super kind of see me through. But in terms of getting ready for that, so it's the, you know, the books, you know, the bookcases and so on, you just plow through those. Then also there's some quite handy reenactor groups around who can give you some very, very interesting insights into aspects of maintaining armor. You know, the best way to clean it apparently is to use abrasive sand for chainmail. You just put it in there, grind it around a bit, and then rinse it out. And that gets rid of the rust much, much better than, you know, anything else. So there's some pretty hot tips you can take from that. And you lard that into the story to give it that sort of credibility. And then the other big thing, I think, is to make sure that you, if you can, and sometimes, of course, if I'm right, setting the book in the Far East, Middle East, it's a little bit difficult, get to the place where the books are actually set. Now, luckily, I was able to get to the middle of the Jordanian desert in Syria and to research some of the books before all that became impossible. So, and I think that's important because it's hard to fake the sensation of being in particular places. So, for example, in Jordan, if you're standing on top of the, you know, Wadi Araba, you know, the air is pin sharp because there's no humidity. So you can see clearly, you know, 30, 40 miles away, you know, across from a sort of 4,000 or 5,000 meters up, you can see that distance very clearly. When you're in Egypt, for example, at 9 o'clock in the morning on the banks of the Nile, and it starts hitting sort of mid-30s centigrade, you know, that is a very particular experience, as is being subjected to Nile mosquitoes. And, you know, those buggers are huge, I can tell you, and they're relentless. So you need to be there, really, to sort of soak it up and to, because when you get back to the word processor, I mean, I do take some notes, but, you know, I'm very, very conscious of the environment when I do the research trips, and you kind of soak it away in your head. And then it's a case of, I think Stephen King describes it beautifully in his book on writing, that after you start working, after about 10, 15, 20 minutes, he says, you begin to see through the page. And he's right. There's that sense in which you're doing this, you know, tap, 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 tap. But at the same time, you can kind of hear, you can kind of smell, you can kind of see the environment that you're writing about. And I think when that happens, then that allows you to, as you say, you know, parachute into this alien world with a degree of credibility and to make it available to the reader. And of course, what we mustn't forget in this process is that I'm only doing half the work here. You know, it is black marks on white paper at the end of the day, and the reader, you know, and what you have to do is make it easy for the reader to translate those into something that is as real to them as it was to me when I put the words down. And I think that's really the heart of the craft.
So do you find yourself kind of, before you start this process, envisaging certain scenarios? Oh, I'd like to put person X in situation Y, and then you go to these places and go, this really isn't going to work. I'm going to have to stick that idea in the bin and actually spin this very differently.
That happens sometimes, but it's called historical fiction for a reason. You know, sometimes the story, you know, you have to sort of bend the facts to make the story work. And then you own up to it in the author's note at the end. Case in point would be when I was writing about Napoleon, because when he was a young officer, he seemed to spend rather more of his time in Corsica on holiday than he did serving in the French army. And he took, something like a dozen trips between France and Corsica. And I thought, well, if I, you know, make it that way in the book, it's going to be more travelogue than an exciting novel. So I boiled it down to basically three trips and owned up to that fact in the author's note. And I think sometimes, you know, you have to do that because I'm not writing, you know, pure history. What I'm writing, what I would, you know, my goal as a historical novelist is to get people interested in history, to get them to understand why I'm so fascinated in a particular character or an event or, you know, a particular setting. And that's the primary purpose. And that means I have to kind of bend things a little in order to get them there, rather than put them off, which is would be very, very easy to do if I sort of mentioned all 12 of those trips. Then, you know, that's kind of what you, that's the, one of the compromises you have to make. And of course, there are many compromises in writing historical fiction, and also to a degree in writing straight history. You know, particularly if you're writing, you know, a historian writing some sort of hagiographic account of Cromwell or something like that, you know, you'll throw in a few warts, but it's mostly going to be hagiography, let's face it, because you're a fan of Cromwell. And it's the same thing with historical fiction. You know, you want your readers to identify with your characters. That means that there are going to have to be some sort of anachronisms there, because, you know, the Romans were fairly brutal and unpleasant people. You know, that's the nuts and bolts of it. And if we were to try and accurately reproduce them as far as we can, which would be a very, very rough guess in any case, even if we were to go halfway down that track and approach some semblance of verisimilitude, the reality would be that, you know, most readers will think, oh, no way am I, you know, Macro and Cato, no way. You know, these are not people I would drink in a pub with, you know, because I'd probably get glassed by Macro. And, you know, Cato would, you know, if he was realistic, would sort of have some very, very unacceptable political views and so on. So, you know, you have to make that, that's one of the compromises you also have to make in translating history into historical fiction for a readership that will actually accept that version of events. And of course, you're going to have, there's a question to do with, you know, what happens when you do get it wrong and you get some anorak turn up to tell you something. And that happens surprisingly rarely, which I'm relieved to say. But when it does happen, you know, sometimes I have to say, it's one of the pleasures of writing is slapping them down.
Let's jump to the contemporary, really, because you've not just stuck to Rome, which we'll be talking about then. But when you're writing an FBI thriller, like, you know, playing with death, how does your mindset change, or is it the same sort of skills? Because you're not immersed in a historical world, you're in a very real one where maybe your constraints are slightly different.
Well, that's you know, it's interesting you bring that one up, actually. I mean, that's one of the books I'm most proud of, but, you know, which sold very, very, you know, few copies, because I think the publisher basically was trying to sort of say, oh, people who are interested in Rome will of course be interested in something set in the near future about artificial intelligence and virtual reality. It's a no-brainer. And unfortunately, that marketing ploy didn't really work for some reason. Who knows? But anyway, Playing with Death was actually an idea. The idea I had for that, I had about 5 years before I even thought about writing for ancient Rome, because I'd read something in the Sunday Times about the internet and, you know, the early days of the internet. And within 5 years, the porn industry, the online porn industry, was worth more to the American economy than the car industry. And that fact really kind of shocked me. And I thought, you know, and at the same time, I was thinking about, you know, virtual reality, because I think Tron had come out or something like that. And, you know, I'd seen a few years before. And I thought, well, you know, if we get decent VR, one of the very, very first applications will be sex and, you know, and pornography. And then, of course, when artificial intelligence comes along. And so I came up with this idea and I thought, well, you know, what could be better for your, you know, anorak wearing sexual pervert than VR with AI? So that, you know, it felt like you were really abusing somebody rather than just some sort of avatar. So that became the basis of this detective novel set in California. And originally it was set actually in Britain, and it was going to be a radio play. But then when I was talking about it with one of my former students, Lee Francis, who I co-wrote the book with, who'd worked in the film industry, and he said, no, this is one we originally developed it as a TV series. But that takes forever. So I said to him, look, why don't we write it as a novel whilst we're waiting for the TV series to come off? And even if it doesn't, then we can always sell the rights for the novel. Then we can get sell, you know, be paid for writing the scripts. We get paid three times instead of two. So that's why we did it. And it was a real interesting exercise, working, co-writing for the first, I'd already done a bit of co-writing with Tim Andrews for some Roman projects, and that worked really well. So I was kind of less prejudiced against the idea of working with Lee, because he's quite a bit younger and he comes from a film background. So it's all about dialogue with him. His idea of writing a story is, day, 9 o'clock, setting this, then straight into the dialogue. I said, well, Lee, that's not how we do it as writers. We have to do the scene setting. So, but his dialogue was really, really crisp. So we worked on that together, and we were dealing with some pretty, I don't know if you haven't read it, I would recommend it, because it's a real kind of water cooler of the moment kind of novel. We worked with an FBI guy, because the person who's the heroine of the story is an FBI agent. And unfortunately you can't credit them, that's the deal. They will help you, but you can't name the individual who helped you in the acknowledgements. And this guy was very, very helpful. And at the end, when we sent him a copy, he said, it's the most accurate version of a novel starring FBI people he's ever read. So I thought, yeah, we got that right. And it was just, I just don't understand why it didn't sort of succeed. We did it, ticked all the right boxes. And it was, a very, very different prospect from writing anything historical. But at the same time, like anybody else, I'm interested in history. I'm interested in the whole span of history, but I'm equally interested in what's going to happen. And I'm very much into sort of science fiction and futurology and so on. And I'm very concerned also in the way that, we look at VR, we look at AI, we look at the ways those things are exploited by corporations and multinationals and so on. And it's not like there isn't a precedent for that in history. So it's quite clear to see the way that certain things will turn out. And of course, somebody comes up with the internet, and so the porn industry leaps on board. And of course, they're the people that pioneered credit card payment. They're the people that pioneered JPEGs and so on, and the first video sharing facilities and so on. So all of that was driven by the porn industry. So, which tends to be forgotten when people talk about the origins of the internet and how it's developed, all these things. You're thinking, yeah, but it's all basically down to, these pervy little anorak guys who came up with the technology to exploit other pervy little anorak guys. And that's what we were kind of, Lee and I were trying to, be a little bit warning about, what happens when you blend AI and VR in a kind of the context of sexual exploitation. It's worrying stuff.
I can remember the days when I was given geography projects at secondary school on the south coast of France, and you'd type words like Nice beach into a Google search function, and you'd get very different results to what you were anticipating as an 11-year-old trying to do their geography homework.
I'll tell you something. When I was teaching, one of the guys in the English department was doing something on Louisa Alcott. So he typed in Little Women, and the next thing we know, the IT department, watchdogs are kicking down the door and saying, what the fuck are you searching for?
Can I stay with that co-authoring thing?
Can I just say, you're making me feel old that you had Google at secondary school. We had this big box in the corner of the room with like a green screen. We're a mix of ages here on History Hack.
You're wearing it well, Boney. Wearing it well. Let me stay with the co-authoring thing for a moment, because I kind of approach this from a history perspective. And in an alternative universe where myself and Matt sit down to write something about Napoleon, for example, for me that would be an absolute nightmare, partly because I'm a control freak, let's be honest. But also, historians have a different way of doing these things, because we tend to carve it up and sort of say, you do that bit, I'll do this. And then we never kind of go through the process of smoothing over the ripples and getting the tone consistent. You can't do that. You have to keep the tone consistent, because you've got paying guests, if you will. You've got people who are paying their money to have that consistency of tone. And if you chop and change, it doesn't work. So how do you deal with the fact that you've got something that's sort of your baby, but it's also somebody else's baby, and you've got to work with this sort of other person who's in the room?
Well, you know, there's no guarantee it will work. That's always the thing. And this, you know, these aren't the first two people I've worked with on projects. I've you know, worked also with my younger brother on a film script a few years ago, and that was okay. But where it works, it seems to be the case that you know, you have to find someone that you have sort of a similar view of things with. That helps a big deal. But then in the process of writing, what tends to happen is, like, you know, I write, say, the first 10,000 words, then they go over to TJ Andrews or to Lee, and then they will sort of like edit that. They will add a bit, then they'll add their 10,000 words and send it back. Now, I will see what they've changed, and I'll think, well, actually, you know, he's right. That actually makes a, you know, that's better if we do it that way. And that's more often the case than not. And it's the same thing with them, because, you know, then I will edit some of their stuff, and so it goes back. So what you're getting is this process of perpetual kind of refinement between people who think along this, on the same wavelength. And it actually works quite well. And it's exciting as well, because, you know, quite often they'll come back with something and they'll have changed something, and you'll think, of course, yeah, that's what it could have done. That's what it should have done. And so you go with that. And then you see something that they offer and you think, yeah, but what if we did this? And then, you know, you add that into the mix. And so there is this lovely kind of, you know, spiral of constantly improving, and the story doesn't necessarily, you know, turn out the way you originally thought it was going to go. And that's also an added pleasure to the process, because, you know, in a way, that's kind of how I work anyway. I only write, Wellington Pelling was different because, you know, big historical characters, loads of stuff, and you have to stick with a certain sort of outline. But with Macro and Cato, you know, frequently, I don't know how the story's going to end. I mean, I know where it's stuck, where it's set, because I've been somewhere and I thought, yeah, that's really good, or I've read something, I think that would be a good basis for a story. You know, I know, you know, obviously who the hero is going to be, and I know who the antagonist is going to be, and what the problem will be. But the synopsis for the novels, Macro and Cato novels, is never more than half a side of A4, because I want to find out, you know, what's going to happen in the course of writing the novel. You know, and it's the same thing to a degree with the German series that I'm writing as well. You know, I knew what was going on. I knew who the ultimate, you know, villain was going to be, but everything in between, you know, was up for grabs. And you can always do that thing that Raymond Chandler said, you know, if you find the pace of the story is going a bit slow, have some guy walk into the room with a gun, you know. Works for me.
I love that line. It's because in his books you can tell when he's run out of pace, because literally happens every other book, doesn't it, in Chandler's book. Anyways, we digress. We'll come back to him in a minute, I think. Let's start talking about some of the specific series here. The Wellington and Napoleon series, in honor of Zach, who I have sitting on the screen below me. You started these in the mid-2000s. What's that, I guess, really, that sort of, what prompted you to make that switch from Rome to the Napoleonic era and start diving into the lives of these rather similar yet rather different people that we think we know so much about?
Well, that that came out as a result of a visiting lecturer who came to the University of East Anglia once and to talk about the French Revolution. And it was really an interesting talk. And then somebody said at the end, when it came to questions, somebody asked and said, you know, so, you know, all of that aside, what do you think the main consequences of the French Revolution were? And this guy said, well, I think it's a bit too early to say. And I thought, wow, you know, that's really, really fascinating. A perspective, you know, very long view you're taking there, mate. And of course, it's true. I mean, the French Revolution changed everything. It killed the idea of divine right of kings quite effectively for a lot of European nations. And I thought, well, you know, this is, I think it's, you know, actually probably the most important historical event of the last 200 and a bit now, years, because it changed so many things. It was the culmination of a whole process of, you know, iconoclastic thinking and in terms of science, in terms of politics, in terms of philosophy, in terms of art. All of that was happening at the same time. And then you have this major political upheaval where, you know, there's an attempt to kind of almost like rebuild France from the ground up with a new calendar, new sort of religion, all these sorts of things were going on. And I thought, well, this is kind of pretty cataclysmic. And on the one hand, you have France, and on the other hand, you have this kind of stuck in its kind of rut Britain. And how do you kind of write a narrative that embraces both of those perspectives? And of course, you discover that Wellington and Napoleon are born in the same year. They're both born in islands, you know, on the provincial islands, to very, very minor aristocracy in Napoleon's case, but minor aristocracy in Wellington's case. And, you know, you wonder to the degree to what would have happened to both of them if the French Revolution hadn't have happened. You know, so it becomes the making of them. And in turn, of course, they become the making of subsequent events. So I thought that it would be a really, really interesting way to kind of explain the process through these two leading individuals. Now, you know, obviously, you know, Wellington's much less of a leading individual than Napoleon, but ultimately, you know, he's the guy that puts the seal to Napoleon's career in many ways, of course. I mean, it's not just that he beat him at Waterloo, with a little help from the Prussians. It's also that, you know, he basically caned French interest in Spain pretty substantially and invaded the south of France. So it's, you know, a lot of the reason why Napoleon fell is down to the way that Wellington, you know, campaigned. And also he did it with a very kind of modern perspective in terms of, you know, he didn't just see himself as the general of the troops. He saw himself as a kind of roving ambassador and foreign secretary, making policy on the hoof on the ground, as it were. And of course, you know, that and the fact that he became a major statesman afterwards, I think, you know, is perfectly understandable given his political skills. And not only is he sort of doing that role, he's also having to play the part of a very, very political general, because he's got a troublesome older brother who's making, you know, waves in London. And he's got quite a few subordinates who have powerful political connections, who he has to be very, very careful about, you know, in terms of disciplining them. And boy, did they need some disciplining in some cases. And of course, he's the guy that's in charge of the largest field army in the British Army. And a bit like Jellicoe at Jutland, you know, he's the guy that could have lost the war in an afternoon just as easily. So he's got to balance all those sort of things. So, you know, it's funny, you know, as I started this series out, because, you know, being a slightly left of center, you know, my sympathies were initially with Napoleon, who I thought was, you know, this kind of self-made man who was utterly brilliant. I mean, I had no doubt about that. You know, he was a first-rate intellect, but he was a man with no moral center. And that became increasingly, you know, understandable as the thing went on. With Wellington, you know, it was quite funny that I didn't really like him, you know, cold, aloof, crusty aristocrat. And he was, you know, I didn't particularly warm to him. But in the course of writing the novels, and you do the research and you find out, you know, some aspects of the man's character, you think, no, you know, this, much as I don't like his politics, you know, I utterly admire him for, you know, the way he does things. A case in point would be, he sent out some junior officer to go and buy some cattle from, I think it was a Portuguese landowner for the army rations. And the kind guy came back empty-handed, and Wellington said in the evening, you know, what the hell happened? And the guy said, well, he demanded that I sort of go down on my knee and beg for the right to buy the cattle. And I said to him, no British officer is going to bloody well do that, some bloody Portuguese person. So anyway, Wellington then got on his horse, rode to this guy's farm, you know, estate, went down his knee and got the cattle. Now, you know, that says a lot about a man in that kind of position, that he, you know, he sublimates everything to the cause. You know, it's all about his particular vision and anything goes. And you just couldn't imagine half the officers in the British Army, you know, even contemplating doing anything like that. You still can't, frankly. You know, a lot of them today are completely stuck up their own arses. There's a lovely book by Simon Acken that came out a few months ago called The Changing of the Guard, about the British Army since 9/11. And when you read that, it's pretty bloody sobering stuff about just how wrong-headed the senior ranks of the British Army still are to this day.
What I really like about that, and the people who are listening to this won't have known, but as you were talking about Napoleon and kind of your transition in thinking about both Napoleon and Wellington, I was just giving you the thumbs up the whole way, because you just kind of explained everything that I tried to talk to people about.
There is that story about Napoleon that when he was talking about defending Paris, and he said, you know, I don't care if Paris is, you know, shelled into the sort of Stone Age sort of thing. You know, we will not surrender to... You're thinking, that sounds rather like a sort of more recent dictator and Berlin, frankly. The more I read about him, the more... And of course, the other thing that... I just mentioned this because I just think it's one of the fascinating aspects of history is that, I write about these two guys and they're there from the start right through to the, you know, to Waterloo. But the thing is that there were three occasions when Wellington should have gone on a ship to travel somewhere, but was too ill, and the ships foundered and everybody went down on them, a few days after leaving port. There were several occasions where, you know, Napoleon was wounded in the thigh by a bayonet in Toulon. And then there was, there are numerous sort of shells exploding by him. And there was one instance, I mean, again, you know, luck, but also, again, this thing about the minds of these people. In 1814, there was a mortar shell that was fired near him in front of a rank of his soldiers. And he, you know, it was going to go off in about sort of, you know, in the next few seconds. And he knew exactly what to do. So he rode his horse over the top of the mortar shell. So it took the full blast. It was killed outright and, you know, dropped dead underneath him. But, you know, he'd saved a good 20 of his men and possibly his own life. But he knew, you know, what to do in the most ruthless possible fashion in that fraction of a second. And I think it's that kind of luck, but at the same time, you know, the ability to instantly grasp the opportunity or the need for what needs to be done. And that's what sort of characterized, I think, both Wellington and Napoleon.
You're preaching to the choir here, as you know, but Matt will be hugely relieved to know that I'm not about to spend the next 3 hours discussing the Napoleonic era with you. But I do want to stay with the whole Wellington-Napoleon dynamic for a minute, because one thing that I particularly like about the way in which you tell that story is the way you cut between the two perspectives. Mm-hmm. But to do that, you've got to do something that's incredibly challenging to people who spend their entire lives studying one of these people, which is to get inside their head. So how do you go about that process of trying to be in someone's mind and kind of see through their eyes? Because you are writing as Wellington, you write as Napoleon in the course of these novels. How do you kind of achieve that mindset to be able to then portray them on the page?
Well, I mean, obviously you read a lot of biographies and you try and read a range of biographies as well. I mean, one of the things if I'd known before I'd started, I don't think I'd have, you know, done the project. I pitched it to the publisher, we got the contract, I started work. And then of course I discovered that there are over 100,000 biographies of Napoleon. You know, you think, well, I'm not gonna read all of those. But the thing is, you get, there's a whole range of them. So there's a sort of standard kind of biographies, and then there's a whole raft of them of people who served with him. So there's one from one of his cooks, there's one of his butlers. And, you know, once you start peeling away, you know, these kinds of biographies, you get some very, very interesting insights, you know, some sort of tics of the character. And once you sort of look at these as symptoms of an internal process, then you begin to think, okay, well, you know, there's enough consistency here in the way that he responds to this. You think, okay, well, why does he respond the way he does? And of course, you know, that's where you part company from proper historians, if you call them that, like yourself. You're making educated guesses. I mean, actually, that's what proper historians do. But I think, you know, with historical fiction, you're just pushing that envelope slightly further, because you're going inside the thought processes and you're thinking, okay, best guess, this is kind of why they did, they're motivated to do this particular thing. This is why they reacted in this particular way. And that's how you kind of go about it. And of course, you know, the reality is that there are probably as many different versions of Napoleon and Wellington as there are people who, you know, who are interested in the subject or even read the books. And that is always the case. I mean, that is the thing about the printed word, is that why it's so powerful, is that everybody's reading of one of my novels is unique. You know, if they were to make it into a film, it would be the same film for everybody. And I think, that's kind of That's one of the reasons why I like history so much, is that, you know, there is this tendency to try and treat it as monolithic, but it isn't. It's this vastly atomized thing through which people attempt to draw things together to make narratives, and that's as good as it gets. But you know, that means we're always going to be in work, and there will always be stories to tell.
Just on that point of drawing the narrative, you've got a very defined journey for your two characters. We'll call them characters here because they're your books. You're doing what you want with them. But unlike your sort of half side of A4 for Macker and Cater, when you've got very well-known journeys for your two characters, does that limit you in a way? Or like you said, do you try to just get in their head more to sort of take that, you know, you can't take, you know, Wellington off to America, for example, even if you have a really good idea for it. That's a different type of
what sort of Wellington in the Hollywood years, that novel.
Yes, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Like, yeah, like the Book of Mormon, only with Wellington showing up for 3 days for something important.
Oh. You know, it's different, isn't it? I mean, if you're writing about Macker and Cater, you're writing about fictional characters against a historical background, huge amount of latitude. If you're writing about Wellington and Napoleon, as you say, you know, you are constrained by very, very well-known facts and timelines. There is a degree, as we've talked about with, you know, him flitting to and fro from Corsica, Napoleon, that you can edit things down, boil things down, distill things a bit. But ultimately, you are confined by the facts. There are, you know, I mean, I did invent a few episodes, you know, for example, when they meet, because they were both in France when they were young men. Wellington was at an academy, some sort of riding school for aristocrats who were a bit dim, that we specialize in Britain. And he'd been sent to France to get a bit of an education in riding and sort of military things. And at the same time that Napoleon was at the military school in France. And I thought, well, you know, okay, I'm sure they would have sort of social and, you know, things. So I contrived this meeting as young men, which would be really interesting. And then one last time after Waterloo, when, you know, Wellington, you know, is secretly sort of taken to meet Napoleon, you know, to discuss terms of surrender, and then realizes he's never going to give in. And I just wanted that as kind of to bookend that relationship, because, you know, apart from that, they never met. Apart from sort of watching each other through telescopes at Waterloo. And that was about it.
Can I ask about a very different setting now, which is about Blackout, which is a book that came out earlier this year. It feels like, from what you've said already, I gather that it is going to be part of another great series. It's set in Berlin during the Second World War. And as soon as I heard about this and your publicist got in touch with us, I kind of sat there and thought, this is bold for, you know, really obvious reasons in terms of setting. So why pick wartime Berlin as a location?
This actually came out of an idea I had for a one-off novel I was going to write about a serial killer in Alderney during the Second World War, because it's the, you know, at the time, most, there are only something like 20 British people who, Alderney people, who stayed on the island during the war. The rest were evacuated when the Germans turned up. But it was also the only place on British Isles that we had a concentration camp. And there were something like 6,000 workers toiling away on Alderney to turn it into a fortress. And I thought, it's an island, 3.5 miles long, 1.5 wide, you know, perfect ground for a serial killer and a confined kind of story. And, you know, and then it occurred to me that the German police officer who would be sent to investigate this from Berlin would have had to have done something really, really awful to be sent to Alderney, because that's the kind of place it was. You know, if you committed some kind of sin, you'd get sent to Alderney, because it's the most boring posting in the Reich. And so then I thought, well, I've got to find out what he did in Berlin that was so wrong that would, you know, get him sent there. So that, of course, leads into the researching into Berlin police in wartime years. And that became a real, rather a long journey, because there's just so much good material. And I was working my way back, you know, I thought, well, I need to know this guy's entire career. So then it occurred to me, well, you know, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to have to write the pre-novel where we cover the reasons why he's sent there. And then, of course, as soon as you think that, you think, well, there's a series here. But where do we start it? And I thought, well, why not at, you know, the beginning of the war? Because it's a really, really fascinating moment for a number of reasons. Firstly, so it's, you know, the end of 1939 and the winter into 1940. Certainly that's where the first two novels are. First novel is that Christmas. You know, the war's been declared. Poland's been defeated. And so there's a feeling that the war's over because, you know, France and Britain, why will they continue to fight? Poland doesn't exist anymore. There's no reason. So they were fully expecting, you know, peace in the spring. And so there was this real unreal ambience about the capital. And then, of course, you've got the worst winter for living, you know, in living memory, where temperatures didn't get above zero until March. And it got down to sort of minus 20 in Berlin on a regular basis. So you've got this absolutely horrific winter, coal shortages, rationing. And then added on top of that, of course, you've got the blackout itself, which the Germans put in place very, very strictly right from the off. And almost immediately, deaths from road accidents and accidents, you know, other kind of accidents shot up, as did crime, as did prostitution. And it changed behaviors. So people were a lot more willing to sort of, you know, have affairs and do, you know, to listen to sort of jazz music and to do all sorts of things that they couldn't do quite so openly before. So there was this very, very strange kind of ambience. And then I came across this sort of reference, but it, I mean, it actually happened in 1940 and 41, this guy who was killing people on the railway system. And so I thought, okay, well, that's his first case, because I thought this is really, really interesting. And it fits beautifully with the whole kind of blackout setting. And we'll go from there. And part of the reason I got interested in this is just because the absolutely monumental mindfuck that is Nazi Germany in so many ways, you know, it isn't just that they're a bunch of, you know, Hugo Boss uniform wearing, you know, goose steppers or anything like that. It's more to do with the fact that, you know, it's the way that they completely transform the way an educated, highly developed society operated within the space of a few years, and turned it into this kind of self-policing police state in many ways. And it's also the absolutely uncompromising nature of their ideology. So that, for example, they refused to accept that Einstein was right because he was Jewish. And what Germany needed was Aryan physics, you know, like race, like science kind of goes, yeah, well, it's, of course, it's different for Aryans, you know. And it's the same thing with Aryan art and Aryan science, and Aryan medicine, you know. And they were really, really big on, for example, homeopathy. And it's the Nazis that kind of insisted that, you know, there was an equivalence between quack doctors and real doctors. So you've got a lot of all this sort of thing going on. And the book I'm writing now, the follow-up to it, is about the Action T4 program, which is basically the means by which they started secretly euthanizing mentally and physically handicapped children. And then, of course, you discover, and you're doing the research on this, that, yeah, the Nazis, you know, gassed, and they, you know, they start, the first people they gassed were the kids, that they gassed 20,000 of these German kids in the course of the war. But until 1960, Sweden euthanized 60,000 kids. Who knew? What about Denmark? So, you know, similar sorts of policies were going on in Denmark, Norway, the USA. And of course, the Nazis become the repository of all evil. But the reality is anti-Semitism was rife across Europe and America. You know, these sorts of neo-Darwinist ideas of, you know, the purity of the race and things like that were very, very popular in all sorts of countries. And yet, you know, we've kind of created Nazi Germany as this, as I say, this repository for evil, you know, so that we can project, you know, all the crap that we were up to. Shocking. So, I mean, it's an absolutely fascinating era, you know, for all those sorts of reasons. And then, of course, you've got the parallels of the modern world, where you look at, you know, some of the, I mean, God almighty, when you're reading Hitler and Goebbels on propaganda, it's almost like you're looking over Nigel Farage's shoulder sometimes, or him and Boris Johnson, you know, always underestimate the mind of the voter. Only give them three-word slogans and repeat them very often. Get Brexit done, you know. Don't elect Corbyn. Keep foreigners out. You know, this sort of thing goes a hell of a lot further than, you know, the left's, well, of course, we have to understand this is a very complex issue. Now, if you'll sit down and you'll give me 3 hours, I'll tell you why. You know, and I was thinking about this the other day, actually. You know, politics is like a song. You know, I was singing in the car on the way to Norwich the other day. And it was one of those songs where, you know, you join in with the chorus because you know the chorus. And the rest of the song, you go, la, 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 la. It's a bit like, you know, singing the Welsh National Anthem. So, you know, you kind of there in the car, and that's what's going. And I thought, yeah, you know, what the right does is they sing the chorus. The left always sings the verses. That's why they lose. So, yeah, I'm in blackout, you know, constantly. All, as I'm writing it, you know, something comes up in the news and I'm thinking, oh, no, here we go again.
I want to ask about something you were talking about in terms of that. I don't want to use the word culture because that has completely the wrong kind of connotations to this, but that sort of sense of uneasiness that kind of ripples all the way through the novel in terms of the fear and your protagonist kind of not knowing who he can trust in the slightest and being really concerned about what other people are saying and the impact that that might have on them. And it's part of this kind of thing about navigating the complexities of writing a novel that set it in the Third Reich. And the choice of character struck me as really interesting here because of the way that they're trying to deal with these issues. So what was it that made you think Inspector of Police? Was that just because initially you wanted to write a crime novel and so, you know, automatically you're going to go that way? Or was this kind of a conscious decision about, if I want to write a hero into this novel, I need somebody who's not going to be an Aryan SOB?
Yeah, well, it was going to be a crime novel. So, the hero had to be something to do with the police or a detective or something like that. That was a given. But, you know, more importantly, you know, and what kind of has all the, you know, the shimmering between the past and the present going on, you know, is someone who, you know, believes in the rule of law in a society run by people who don't, you know, someone who believes in the authority of knowledge and fact and evidence in a society where that is kind of immaterial, you know. What counts is, you know, who's loudest, not who's wisest. And of course, you know, in the age of Trump, in the age of Johnson, in the age of Farage, in the age of Facebook and social media, you know, we're kind of scratching the same ground again, aren't we? You know, and that's what kind of struck me. And that's why, you know, at the end of the novel, when he goes to see Heydrich and he, you know, they've solved the crime, they know who the killer is. And he's, you know, he's saying, we need to tell people about this. And we need to tell the families, you know, we need to have this on record. And Heydrich says, you know, who do you think you are? You don't own the truth anymore. We do. And that, of course, is, you know, the kind of world that we're living in now, because, you know, we saw this with the last election after the near run, 2017 thing where Corbyn, you know, broke the records in terms of achieving a political swing and became a very, you know, real danger to the conservative establishment. They went for him all guns blazing and came up with all sorts of smears and lies and things like that. And the thing is, you know, what works these days, you know, knowledge, you know, what passes for knowledge seems to be that thing which gets recycled with the greatest velocity rather than that thing which, you know, has the greatest verisimilitude, you know, and that is the nature of the world in which we live. And, you know, this is very much part and parcel of the way that the, you know, life was under Nazi Germany. You know, facts no longer mattered. What mattered was, you know, being on message. And, you know, and it's slightly more complicated than that as well, because, you know, there is a temptation to think about Nazi Germany as this, yes, the trains ran on time and it was ruthlessly efficient and that's what the Germans are like and so on. And the reality was that it was anything but that. It was, you know, a society written by political factions, who were trying to second guess what the Führer would, how the Führer would react. There's a lovely German phrase, which I can't remember the German for, but basically the British translation is, you know, obeying orders before they are given. So this is, you know, what seemed to be driving the Nazi bureaucracy, you know, trying to anticipate how Hitler would react to the policy that they, you know, and then, you know, framing the policy in those terms. So it's quite credible, for example, that, you know, Hitler didn't necessarily envisage, you know, concentration camps, but it was kind of delivered because they knew that that's actually what they thought he wanted, you know, and that's what was kind of the driving animus for, you know, people like Heydrich and Himmler and so on. Yeah, that's how it is. And you begin to wonder, you know, with leaders like Trump and to a lesser extent Johnson, you know, how much of policy, you know, is made up by their underlings. You know, with a view to how Trump's going to react or how Johnson's going to react to something. And you get that sort of sense that there's a lot of freelancing going on lower down the ranks, you know, by, you know, Kushner in say, America. And over here, you've got, you know, with the likes of Gove and To a lesser extent, people like, I have to say lesser extent, because you kind of look at Rob, you think, man, hasn't got a brain cell in his body. You know, he just seems to be, you know, moving from one cock up of an interview to the next. But I'm sure there are some people in the Tory party who actually know what they're about, possibly Mogg. It's a bit hard, really. You look at Mogg and you think, there's something eerily 30s and Teutonic about his hairstyle, isn't there? That sort of shave.
The cut of his suits as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's a double-breasted man, isn't he? Can you trust him?
Yeah, that's right. He's not the sort of member for the, you know, what they say, the 1870s, the member for the 1940s, I think.
Just before we move on to the new book, I've got a couple of bits about Blackout. First off, you've given Schenk a great backstory with motor racing, so I adore the motor racing in the 30s, the complexities, the politics of it. Yeah, Nuvolari, Dick Seaman, all of those guys. Is it just you being a motor racing fan that you wanted to be able to squeeze the greats into your character's backstory? Or what made you make him a racing driver before he was a cop?
Couple of things, really, because I wanted him to have, you know, social connections. And if you've come from a sort of bourgeois background in Germany, that kind of limits the situation. If you're a celebrity, then of course, you know, everybody wants to be your buddy. So that's going to open a lot of doors for him. And, you know, you could have made it a film star, but then of course everybody would recognize him wherever he went. You know, the fact that he's a motor racing person means that, you know, because they had hats and goggles on, yeah, you'd kind of, the aficionados would know him on sight, but everybody else might know the name. And I thought that would be, you know, as I say, open a few doors for him socially. But at the same time, you know, you want something to sort of mark your character out. And I think one of the interesting things that have interested me in recent years is, you know, how do people cope with celebrity? You know, being an author, that's not a problem. It really isn't, you know. But if you're a film star or a sports star, or, you know, you're on even the weather person, you know, people know your face. And, you go on to things like Strictly Come Dancing and stuff like that. And there's this whole industry that sort of works around just that, you know, the recognition factor. One of the beauties, of course, is, you know, of writing, you know, you may sell millions of books in 20 different languages or whatever, but in my entire life, I've been recognized once. And that was in Spain in a town called Girona, which was really, really funny. Because my editor had taken me there for lunch, and because I was going to talk at the university that afternoon. And this guy, because apparently this restaurant was popular with the academics at the university, and this guy came up and said, "Are you Simon Scarry? The Simon Scarry?" So I have nerd recognition factor, yay!
The second question was one that we did just before we started recording, and we wish we recorded it. So I'm going to ask it again. I'm a huge fan of the Philip Kerr, Bernie Gunter books, mm-hmm. And the question I was asking you is, do you look at, you know, who else has written about this period, or do you just dive in? Because, you know, the Gunter books do have a bit of a long shadow in this sort of thing. But for you, was it stay away from them, or have a look at the competition?
Well, no, I mean, it's a kind of, you know, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because, you know, I'm not the first person to have written about Rome. I'm certainly not the first person to have written about Napoleon and Wellington. So, you know, you kind of, because somebody's done it before doesn't mean there's no reason why somebody else shouldn't have a crack at it, you know. And it's a bit like that whole thing to do with, you know, cultural appropriation. So it's kind of, you know, historical appropriation. Nobody owns a particular era, so everything's open and up grabs, as far as I can, you know, see it. As far as the Bernie Gunter books, I was aware of them because a friend of mine's a big fan, and he told me about them years before I even thought about writing a German detective series. And I'd kind of put it on my, you know, backlist of, you know, I must read that someday sort of thing. But then I started writing it, and then I have a very, very firm policy that if I'm writing about a particular era or a particular trope, you know, generic trope within a particular era, then you don't want to be reading anything that might influence your writing. You know, you do not want to pick up the writing tics of another writer, and because people will pick up on that. So that kind of meant that I couldn't read Philip Kerr. Certainly not until I'd written at least one or two books. And I have, when I finished the first book, I did actually read the opening of one of Philip, I think, because it's, you know, Berlin Noir, I think it's, you know, digested through the book or something. So I started reading that. And it struck me, a couple of things struck me about it. Firstly, one of the characteristics of Nazi Germany was the way that it forced people to kind of contain their personalities. It forced them to contain their opinions to such a degree that you had no idea, however well you knew somebody, and you might even be married to them, you know, that you really had no idea what they were really thinking, because, you know, if there was an argument, they might be calculating, you know, well, will this person denounce me if we have an argument? So therefore, I better be careful about what I say here. So there's a lot of that was going on. And one of the things that, and you'd be very, very careful what you said, because certain things could get you into a lot of trouble, to whoever you said it. So reading, it felt to me that a third person narrative was by far the more realistic way to proceed, because, you know, everybody's the third person in, you know, you don't really get to know people. They are all surfaces. But the problem, of course, with a first person narrative is that you get so sort of intimately involved with this person. That just wouldn't be the case in Nazi Germany. So it didn't feel kind of the right way to do it for me. And certainly some of the things, I know this guy's, you know, hugely more successful than I'll ever be, and highly regarded and so on, but it's a different perspective. It's a different way of understanding how you're going to go about representing this particular period. And, you know, he was very much, you know, on the wavelength of doing Chandler in Berlin. And I was, you know, very much more about kind of doing, I suppose, Prime Suspect, you know, that kind of feel, procedural, capture the zeitgeist kind of novel. So that's, I think, my series is going to be different from the Philip Kerr series.
I need to go read Blackout. I haven't done yet because I have Metropolis, the last Gunter book, sat on the shelf, which I've never read because I want to save it for something. Mm. So I think this is going to sound terrible, but you're going to fill in the gap for me there, Simon.
I'll live with that.
I want to talk about the latest book, which has come out within the last few days of us recording. So Honor of Rome, it's the latest installment of the Eagles of the Empire series. Obviously, you don't want you to give any spoilers, because that's the whole point of doing things like this. People go out and buy the book. But where does this sit within the context of that series? Because it is an epic series. It's what, book 20, 21 now?
Yeah, 20, yeah. XX. Yeah. Well, you know, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, 20 books in, when we kicked this thing off, I thought 10, 12 books. My agent thought we'd be lucky if we'd get away with 6, and my publisher thought it was going to be 3 books and so on. So, you know, who knows anything about how these things would turn out. But of course, you know, I developed Macro and Cato. Macro and Cato are now like old buddies who sit in my head. And when we get round to writing the Macro and Cato book each year, it's like going on holidays with old friends. And I'm little more than an amanuensis these days. You know, they take the story along, they decide what's going to happen, and I just get the words down. So that's kind of how that goes. So I really don't know kind of how that each book is going to turn out. It's up to them to work that out, and I'm along for the ride. But it started off with the invasion, started off in Germania, where, you know, Cato joined in the legions in the first book. And I really wanted to write about the invasion of Britain, but I wanted to totally get the reader on side with the Roman perspective before I let them get out there and start kicking the shit out of British people, you know, ancient versions. Because I thought, well, you know, they're invading Britain, and they're kicking the locals in. And, you know, what's it like to be on the receiving end of imperialism? Mm-hmm. So that was very much kind of, you know, why Cato thinks about this from time to time, probably slightly, I mean, it's not anachronistic. There were plenty of Romans who were thinking about, the barbarian perspective and the other and so on. So it's not like there wouldn't be people like Cato around, but I just wanted to, you know, very much foreground that. Okay, let's sort of identify the imperialists and then, you know, give us a good kicking, and see how we kind of shimmer between those two perspectives. So that was the thinking behind that. And then, and Britannia has become the 20th book is set in as a return to Britannia. And we've been back a couple of times. And it's an interesting one, because what you've got there is a province in the process of being, provincialized, because the fighting's still going on. You know, this is what, you know, actually Britain and Judea were the two toughest provinces for the Romans to keep a lid on. And for very similar reasons, you know, religion primarily, it was the Druids who kept stirring shit up in Britain, and of course the rabbis and stuff in Judea. So there was this kind of interesting setting that you come back to from time to time to see how are things gone on. And this book, Macro thinks he's retired, so he's left the army, and coming back to Britain then in 59 AD, a year before a certain Iceni queen decides that she's going to cause a bit of trouble. So, you know, anybody who knows anything about the history can guess where things go from here. But at the same time, you know, Macro is coming back to Londinium, and it's been, you know, this town's been 10, 12 years old. So it's pretty much a frontier town with very kind of lawless state of affairs and an administration that's trying to keep, you know, ahead of the criminals and developments and so on, was trying to run a province. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Baghdad post-Iraq invasion on steroids. You know, it's that kind of dodgy people coming from Rome to make a fortune, take all the sort of funding and get out quick, and people on the ground sort of wheeler dealer and, you know, making all those sorts of dodgy, you know, deals to for their own advancement. And so that's what kind of, you know, thematically what it's like, as well as delivering the story of, you know, how Macro thinks he's going to retire and goes up against these crime gangs. It's one of the, you know, 20 books in, you know, there are going to be certain people saying, oh, it's a bit formulaic. But, you know, part of why I think the series has lasted as long as it is because, you know, it is sensitive to what's going on in the present world. And that does tend to make, you know, the stories differ from time to time. The previous novel was about a pandemic that breaks out in Sardinia. So, you know, that's, and whilst it's under the control of a rather ineffective, narcissistic lying governor and his bald sidekick, you know, who knew?
I'm just looking at the sort of the dates here. You're sort of, what, 5 years away from the first battle at the first siege of Jerusalem. That's, I'm not wanting to try to guess where you're going to take the series, but yeah, one's just
looking. Yeah, way ahead of me.
So let's just dive in about Rome for a minute. Is, you know, the journey that they've got, Cato and Macro have had it's been epic so far, but you've only sort of touched in small areas. Is that a challenge when you're trying to move your characters through such a vast canvas? Is there bits that you wish you could have delved into, or that you still will and you haven't done it? I'm trying to make you think about things that you haven't written yet.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, when you look at tombstones of Roman soldiers, quite often you'll see their service records there. And there are plenty of them that, you know, say this person served in Germania, Judea, Egypt, blah, 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 Britannia. So we know that the Roman soldiers got around. Some of them, of course, you know, were garrison soldiers entire lives in some peaceful little spot, and, you know, good luck to them. But a lot of them, you know, probably the ones who had slightly more about them and were effective soldiers were the ones that were doing sort of, you know, the fire brigade actions, rushing around the empire to sort of where they were needed. So it's quite, you know, credible that Cato and Macro could have traveled as much as they have across the series. You know, it's been 17 odd years now that in Roman time that the series has been running, and they've been to, you know, Egypt, Judea, Syria, Germania and Britannia, Sardinia and Spain. So that's all kind of, you know, fairly doable, frankly. But of course, you know, one of the things about research is that, you know, if I, you know, for example, when I wrote Gladiator, I was going to write Gladiator, you know, but we went on holiday to Crete to visit the only interesting member of my family, who's my cousin Hannah, who ran away when she was 16 to marry her Greek boyfriend in Crete. So I was catching up with her. And as we were driving through central Crete, you know, we're driving on, there's this road sign that says remains of Roman town, slams the brakes on, you know. And of course, you know, this is the middle of the day and it's really, really hot. And it's ruins of this town called Cortina, which were destroyed by an earthquake in, I think, 47, 47, 49 AD. And I thought, this is, we've got to stop here and have a look. And so, of course, with my then wife and two sons bitching about the heat and needing an ice cream, I took them to the beach and left them and drove back and had a good look. And it occurred to me that, for, you know, this date that there was this earthquake which destroyed the city almost coincides with Macro and Cato coming back from Syria. So I thought, what if they were sailing past the island when the earthquake struck and there's a tsunami which wrecks their ship? And so they, you know, they land in Crete, and then there's everything's gone to shit, you know, the infrastructure, everything. And there's a slave revolt. And so, you know, in the space of about half an hour, I'd worked it all out for a book I was never going to write. And this is what frequently happens, you know, when you're doing the research into Roman history or, you know, some aspect of it, inevitably, you know, at least three or four other projects suggest themselves. So, you know, I'm going to be long dead before I get through about a quarter of the potential plots for Macro and Cato somewhere in the Roman Empire.
I want to ask a bit about the span, because we've said, you know, you're 20 novels in, which means that, you know, the majority of your work has been on the Roman period. Is that, and this is kind of a chicken and egg scenario potentially, but is this because, you know, you have a particular affinity and interest in that world, which you talked about at the start? Or do you find the publishers sort of sit you down and go, okay, can we have another one of these kind of thing? That means that you end up writing more because people are demanding more from you. And so do you kind of have situations where you kind of go, okay, great, I'm very happy to go back to this, but I also want to explore other areas and have to sort of push back against that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, it's about, you know, like any aspect of business, which is, you know, what publishing is, what writing is, you've got to think about strategically. And, you know, all writers have to do this right from the beginning. One of the very first things that you have to you know, be sensible about is if you get a book contract, is you don't give up the day job. My first agent was very, very clear about that. And she said, look, you know, it's not going to be much. It may not work out. You'd be a loony to give up the teaching job. So, and then I spoke to Bernard Cornwell. I did some literary event with him when the first book came out and was talking to him about this. And he said, yeah, absolutely. He said, you know, until you've written five books, a minimum of five books, I wouldn't even dream of, you know, giving up the day job. So that was, you know, step one. The other thing is that, actually, again, it was, I mean, I'd thought of this before I was talking to Bernard about it. He said, it's really, really important to get an established series going. Because, you know, every book that you write will sell, the backlist will sell, and that will finance, you know, the possibilities of doing sort of other projects. But you can't, you know, do the other projects without, you know, a firm basis. So the Macro and Cato series really became the kind of mortgage payer, if you like. And then there are other projects like the Wellington and Napoleon thing I was absolutely passionate about. And luckily that did quite well. And then there are sort of one-off projects that, you know, you write, which the publishers are, you know, there will be a, you know, they may or may not sell big, but they know that they will sell comfortably and they will pay you less for them, but at least you can write them. So I've written about the Siege of Malta in 1565, for example, and the German occupation of Lefkas in the Second World War. So, you know, you can do that. And I also managed to do a young adult series about a boy gladiator for Puffin. And so as long as you've got a, you know, you diversify your product range, you know, in the crudest kind of possible commercial terms. And if you've got a brand, Macro and Cato, that works well, you continue the brand. And it's not like it's a problem to write Macro and Cato stories. You know, I'm going to be doing that until I drop off the twig. And yes, they will be in Jerusalem, that is up there. And they will certainly be there for 69 AD when there's the year of the four emperors and the civil war. So, you know, plot spoilers there, guess the guys can't get hurt, you know. But it's, you know, and the thing about, you know, the delight of doing something as long as 20 books for a series is you really do get a chance to get to know the characters. And you get a chance to sort of follow them through all the various vicissitudes and challenges of a normal life, you know, rather than box it all up in one narrative. And they become bigger than the individual stories, really. And I think that's part of the attraction for the readers. It's not so much you know, who Macro and Cato will duff up this time. It's, you know, what happens in Macro and Cato's lives that they're interested in. They want to know, you know, serial and soap opera fashion, you know, what happens to the characters next. And I think, you know, as a writer, if you're going to be, if you want to, you know, it's very, very difficult to make a living out of writing. Let's be honest about it. The average salary is something like £12,000 a year of every writer. The average, I didn't realize this statistic I heard the other day, the average number of books sold by an author, you know, author books, 400 copies. You know, you're not going to get rich off 400 copies. So, you know, if you want to, if you're serious about making a living out of it, then you have to write frequently. You know, you have to do at least a book a year. And I think you'd be sensible if you wrote a series, because then, you know, you've got a guaranteed market and a body of readers who will follow the series. It will make it possible for you to do other things. And, you know, it seems fairly obvious, but I'm quite surprised by how many writers just seem to think that, you know, you can just write what, you know, what suits you at a particular time. And you know, also you've got to be fairly kind of disciplined about this. I'm not disciplined. I mean, I as I mentioned earlier, you know, I just a lot of time researching, then panic and write, you know, the books that, when the editor phone gives me the phone call. There are authors I know who sort of religiously get up every morning and write 2,000 words and then get on with the rest of their day. And I envy them. But equally, you know, you've got to be, you know, you can't be too precious about it. I remember coming across a writer who'd got a six-figure deal for three books coming straight out of university. Now, that's pretty rare. And her career died because basically she spent 3 years submitting the second book 2 years too late. And I was talking to her about it. And I said, so, you know, what's your writing day like? And she said, I do 250 words a day. And I thought, you know, how the hell are you ever going to get anything written? And I said, well, what about editing? She said, no, I don't edit. When I've written those 250 words, they're perfect. And you're just thinking, you know, that's insane. And, you know, she ended up becoming a creative writing tutor at a university. Who would have guessed? You know, and so her career is now going to be, you know, small books with big words in small print and low sales. That's basically what she's condemned herself to. And if she's happy doing that, good luck to her. But, you know, I always wanted to make a living out of it. You know, I didn't want it to be some sort of mildly pleasing hobby that put a bit of jam on the toast. You know, I wanted it to be the thing that actually, you know, paid me to do some traveling and, you know, go scuba diving and stuff like that. So there's your hot tip. Do a series, keep it going. Yeah. Don't give up the day job.
Oh, but I want to give up the day job. I love what you said there about your characters. You sort of just join them on the ride. Because I remember George MacDonald Fraser saying something similar about Flashman. He didn't like him, didn't like spending time with him. And the quicker the journey was over, the better. But he kept having to come back to him because it was, well, the series, but it was that familiarity with them that you sort of subconsciously know what they're going to do, and it works out.
Well, some people are just horribly, horribly fascinating, aren't they? I mean, you know, nobody wants to go to have dinner with Hannibal Lecter because we know how that's going to turn out. But equally, we want to make sure he's safely behind bars when we have a conversation with him because he's so funny and entertaining and, you know, and quite sort of chilling. But yeah. So, I mean, you know, luckily with Macro and Cato, as I said, it's an unalloyed pleasure, you know, to sit down and, you know, go through the adventures with them because they're just, you know, very, very entertaining guys. And I think partly that's down to, talk about narcissism here. I think my oldest son sort of worked it out pretty early on. He said, yeah. He said, you know, it's obvious, Dad, you know, Cato is how you used to be when you were a student. I thought, yeah, that's true. It's true. He said, Macro is what you've grown up to become. And he's right. You know? That's why I get on with them.
Yeah. Let's turn this around again. Do you have a red list of things that you won't touch? So, you know, periods of things that you just think, wow, that's going to be more trouble than it's worth.
No, I don't have a red list on anything. It's actually the situation isn't writers, it's the publishers. They have a red list, you know. So, for example, it's really, really hard to get a successful novel out of the English Civil War. Why? I mean, it is bloody interesting stuff that's going on there. You know, I came up with an idea for a novel set then about the levelers and the diggers, because I thought, you know, here's a moment in history where things could have gone very, very differently, you know. And she said, yeah, but who's going to read that? And I thought, well, you know, it's important. And she said, yeah, but it's not commercial. And I think that's how publishers tend to work. Rome is commercial. You know, Wars of the Roses, commercial, you know. Napoleonic Wars, commercial. English Civil War.
Tudors.
Tudors, yeah. Some of the East Africa imperialist stories, no, not so good. You know, so it goes. Dark Ages, yes, because you can play about with a bit of mythology there. But, you know, ancient Stone Age, you know, once in a while, not a lot going on there, apart from people hitting each other with clubs and hauling stones about. You know, it's so publishers are looking for... And of course, it's like the film industry. Everybody sort of says, yeah, we're looking for something new and fresh and interesting. They're not. They're looking for the new Marvel movie. You know, that's kind of how it works. And it's the same with publishing. You know, when 50 Shades of Grey came out, I kid you not, one of the first books out of the stable was from my own publisher called 60 Shades of Blue. You know, that's how they work, okay? So don't be, what's important, I think, is not coming up with an original idea. It's coming up with a distinctive voice. It's coming up with, you know, interesting characters. It doesn't matter if, you know, the setting is as hackneyed as anything, as long as you offer something slightly refreshing, you know, or do something in a slightly different way within a period that the publishers think is a sort of sexy commercial prospect, then you're away. You know, it's a fool's game to sort of think, okay, well, I'm really, really interested in the levelers and the diggers, and I'm going to, you know, and everybody else will be, of course, because, you know, this failed transformative moment in British history. Of course, everybody's going to be interested. You know, no, they're not. And certainly from a commercial perspective, the number of copies of books that are going to be sold about your levelers and diggers novel, you know, are going to be smaller than your shoe size, frankly. That's the way it works.
I have visions off the back of your 60 Shades of Blue anecdote that, you know, your publicist is going to turn around to you and go, so how about writing, you know, 10,000 Shades of Red about bizarre.
somebody asked that question at the literary festival and said, you know, are any of your books, you know, would you have done anything differently? And I said, yeah, I'd have called my first book 50 Shades of Crimson. But I mean, you know, that's what happens. It's like, you know, when you remember when the Da Vinci Code came out? Yeah. Then there was the Mozart Codex. There was the Bernini Conundrum and, you know, all these kinds of books that were coming out with these fairly kind of soft focus pictures of archways of people running through them in sort of dark shadowy covers and stuff. Yeah, that's what happens all the time. And of course you get these things where publishers, you know, I mean, they do my head in. I came up with an idea for a vampire novel, which I think would have been really, really good actually. And, we took it to... something I was going to co-write with my brother, and we took it to his publisher, and he said, oh, you know, vampires, that's yesterday's stuff. Nobody's going to be writing about vampires again. A few months later, Stephanie Meyer, you know, that's the way it goes. Vampires are always going to be in vogue, you know, because what is it they do? It's aristocrats sucking the blood of workers. What changes, you know? The vampires these days are likely to be Zuckerberg and, you know, baldy guy, Bezos, and, you know, and it's a similar sort of motif that's still running, you know. So I think that kind of analogy, that kind of metaphor for that exploitation that vampires embody, you know, ain't going away anytime soon. Werewolves less so, because, you know, werewolves are all about, you know, unleashing male sexuality and stuff. And in a world where we're kind of trying to tamper down on that, you know, I think werewolves have got they're going to have their fur and legs trimmed a bit. You know, what else have we got? Zombies? Well, yeah.
Don't you start
social media. Social media. Yeah. That's it. The recipients of social media. Yeah, there's your zombie story.
Yeah. No. So, I'm a big zombie fan.
To
be fair, one of my favorite, I don't particularly like vampires, but Max Brooke did a fantastic graphic novel of putting himself in amongst the vampires in a zombie apocalypse. So food source is dying out. Yeah, that we digress. But zombie, no, don't you start on the zombies. That's
well,
they're a genre that must continue as long as they are slow and George Romero esque. That's the rules.
Make America great.
Exactly. So you mentioned you've been spotted once, really, which I think is terrible. Yeah, this has been fantastic.
Oh, God, no,
and everyone should watch this. You can, now that you've been on our podcast, we're going to put you on our YouTube channel. You're going to be seen everywhere. Promise.
Yeah, but when I take the mask off.
We were talking about some of the fun letters you received earlier about names and things like that. Do you have any of those sort of moments you want to share that just sort of make this sort of tickle you when you look back on
it? Are you talking about the embarrassments we talked about before the recording, or?
Yes.
Yeah. So I had this guy write to me and say, Scarrow, you dickhead. Didn't you know, before he was the Duke of Wellington, everybody knows his name was Arthur Wellesley. So why are you calling Arthur Wellesley, idiot? So, basically 5 seconds on Wikipedia would have sorted that query out. I mean, bless the guy. He's written a letter. You know, he sat down and penned it by hand. He's gone to the post office. He paid for the stamp, put it on the thing and sent it to my publisher, who then sent it on to me. And he could have saved himself all of that effort if he'd gone to Wikipedia and discovered that the family was originally called the Wellesleys. But when Richard, his older brother, inherited the title, he didn't want them to be confused with that awful hymn-composing family, with those sort of dirges that the Wellesleys came up with. So he sort of said, no, we're going back to an earlier version of the name that they hadn't used for sort of three centuries. So, that happens. And yes, it's very satisfying. But once in a while, I mean, I have made some absolute howlers, I'll be honest. And partly, I tend to get the story out quickly and then go back and read over things. But I was a bit rushed one year, and I was talking about some Roman officer in some fort in sort of on the borders of Judea, pining for the comforts of Italy and growing his tomatoes. And of course, tomatoes came from South America. So, mea culpa. So obviously the hardback version has that in the paperback version. We fixed it and turned it into, I think it was aubergines, but it's one of those things. For some reason, it's easily done. Italians, tomatoes, of course they go together. That's kind of blew it on that one. But I rightly got a caning from, a few readers who picked that up, but again, surprisingly few. But now I know all about tomatoes as a result of that. So there's always an upside. So that's a very long answer to a very straightforward question. Apologies.
It was a very good answer. I was just thinking, it's like the apples in Ben-Hur that people complain about because they wouldn't have had apples in the bowl of fruit in Marcellus and the side.
They wouldn't have had wristwatches either.
Well, you like to know what your lap time is, don't you? So.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true. I suppose, they could have... easy enough to do, isn't it? You just kind of get the thing and strap it on and
exactly.
Oh, time is
I'm sure that's a gag in History of the World Part One, I'm sure. What's next?
I'm at the moment, I'm halfway through the next German book, Schenker, and this is it's still winter, it's 1940, and he's looking into some sort of potential, there's a murder of a doctor and the potential murders of some children and how they're connected. So I won't say more about it now. So there's that. And then I've got the Roman book that's just come out ends on the eve of the Boudiccan revolt. So it's possible we may be covering that in the next two books. And then I'm working on a co-written book with TJ Andrews on another character from the, because we tend to pick on characters who've been really, really interesting in this main series and then spin off and do their story. So we're doing another two-book thing on that, which I'm really excited by because it's about some character writing, a Roman historian writing the life story of a character, of a Roman historical character. And so it's that interplay between them about what this guy actually wants known and what this guy wants to tell as the truth, at the same time wants to sell. So it's all about those kind of processes that go into writing hagiographies and what's true, what's not, and why is it that way, so that's going to be really interesting. Other than that, I've got to get ready for Christmas and then possibly a move to another country, so it was I fancy a bit of a change of scene, so winter will do that to you.
And then amongst all of that, no doubt some skiing and scuba diving to boot.
Absolutely, yes. Funnily enough.
Simon, you've been incredibly generous with your time. Thank you so much for joining us on History Hack. Folks, go online. All you've got to do is Google this guy, Simon Scarrow. You'll find the wealth of novels. Boney, I'm sure you'll put the books on our History Hack bookstores so that people can just click the link and it'll be as simple as that.
I think we'll put a selection, because if we put all of them on there, it will basically be the History Hack Simon Scarrow.
This is true.
But not that that's a bad thing for Simon, I don't think.
Yeah. Can I just say this has been actually one of the, you know, I think it's probably been the most entertaining and fun, and certainly some of the best questions, you know, of any of these things that I've done for years now. So thank you very much for the entertainment.
Well, thank you. It's just to say, it's all Zach's hard work. I just show up and steal it. Don't worry.
Yeah, no, but it's been a great, been a great blast actually talking to you guys. So thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for joining us. It's been great. I'm doing the recording, so I have to hit.
Yeah, stop. You've got to stop it.
We'll leave that bit in.
we'll leave that in just to show you were in confidence.
We'll have the love in, and then realise actually we screwed all this up.
Folks, before you go, do me a favour. Like the episode and hit the subscribe button. It'll take you 2 seconds, but it really helps us to spread the work that we do. You can also leave a comment. We'd love your feedback on the episode, what you liked, and let us know whether you want more of this kind of stuff. If you want it, we're happy to do our best to try and provide it. Obviously, all episodes, and particularly bigger projects like this, take a huge investment of time and resources. If you are able to help us cover the costs so that we can grow and expand our content, you can become a regular supporter via Patreon. That's not for everyone, though. So if you want to leave a one-off tip, you can do that via Ko-fi. All the links you need are in the description. And also don't forget that we have a merchandise shop. Boney has put loads of great things together for you. So take a look. Again, the link is in the description. Check out the History Hack bookstore and effectively treat yourself or the History Hack fan in your life. We'll be back in a couple of days. Take care, folks. History Hack out.